States tuned to yesterday, delivering programs from radio's golden years. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark Levionier. True history in this hour. Later on, we'll hear The March of Time from 1935, but right now, the story of John Hancock, adapted on the Hallmark Playhouse. The story, taken from the Lorenzo Sears novel, published in 1912. Sears was an American historian and biographer and served as professor at the University of Vermont through the late 1880s and at Brown University through the turn of that century. With a capable radio cast of Virginia Gregg, Ted Osborne, Herb Butterfield, and Ted DeCorsia, this from December 13, 1951 on CBS.
Remember, a Hallmark card when you care enough to send the very best. Tonight from Hollywood, the makers of Hallmark greeting cards bring you Dana Andrews in the story of John Hancock on the Hallmark Playhouse. Each week, Hallmark brings you Hollywood's greatest stars in outstanding stories chosen by one of the world's best-known authors, the distinguished novelist, Mr. James Hilton.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is James Hilton. Tonight on our Hallmark Playhouse, we dramatize a biography by Lorenzo Sears, the story of a man whose signature may well be the best known in our history, John Hancock. If you've ever visited the Library of Congress in Washington, almost certainly you've examined the actual document of the Declaration of Independence, and you'll have noticed that John Hancock's signature not only heads the list, but is written in letters so strong and firm that, as was said at the time, George III could read it even without his glasses. John Hancock, personally, was rather like his signature, strong and firm. He was also very human and a man of many talents. To play his part tonight, we have chosen one of Hollywood's finest and most popular actors, Dana Andrews. Many people had known John Hancock, but there was one especially, a charming old lady of 84, whose name as a girl had been Dorothy Quincy. Old people like to talk. They like to turn their minds to roam over the past, especially when their own past is already a part of history.
History, yes. His name is in all the history books now. And yet when people ask me, what was John Hancock like? I find it hard to give a simple answer. He had so many different moods, gay and severe, angry and gentle. You know, it almost seems to me there were many John Hancocks, and I knew them all. I'm so proud of that. And, of course, the one I think of first is the young man. The way he looked when he came back from England. Oh, he was so handsome. So assured. Such a grand style in the way he looked and talked. His uncle was very ill and had gone to the house on an errand one morning. And it was young John who opened the door.
Yes?
Oh, I'm calling on Madam Hancock. Is she at home?
Come in. May I ask who's calling?
Well, may I ask who's asking?
Oh, well, I'm John Hancock, Mrs. Hancock's nephew.
John Hancock? Well, I would hardly have recognized you. I'm Miss Quincy.
Miss Quincy? Which Miss Quincy?
Dorothy Quincy.
Dorothy? Why, you were a little girl when I went abroad. You've grown up.
Those things happen with the passing of time, Mr. Hancock.
Yes, evidently.
Dorothy, my dear, how nice to see you.
Good morning, Mrs. Hancock. Mother sent over some jellies for Mr. Hancock.
Oh.
She thought that might tempt his appetite.
Well, that was very kind of her. Have you two young people been renewing your acquaintance?
You certainly have.
Dorothy's my favorite child in the entire city, and certainly the belle of the town.
Yes, I can see why she would be.
Beg pardon. But Mr. Hancock is asking for young Master John. I'll go right up. Good morning, Uncle Thomas.
Good morning, John. Come sit beside me. I have much to talk to you about and little time to say it.
The doctor said you shouldn't tire yourself.
Doctors always passing out pills and shouldn'ts. I am leaving your aunt well provided for. And in your trust, I am leaving my warehouses, my ships, and my faith in the future of these colonies we are trying to raise. You spent a good time abroad. I'd like to know that your mind, your heart, your energies are devoted now to your home.
They will be. My real allegiance is here, not abroad. I'll fight for this land against all enemies. And I'll fight to make her the kind of land of which all men dream. A land where the liberties of the individual are sacred. Where the people are self-governed. Where
you're talking revolution, my boy. We are all subjects of the King of England.
I don't think we're going to remain subjects of the King of England. The King has gone too far of late with taxations. The Lords Parliament has been passing reek of tyranny. It's not to be borne.
If the rest of the lads we've raised in this country think as you think, then there will be revolution. And from revolution, true freedom.
There will be revolution, Uncle Thomas. And there will be freedom.
I wish I might live to see it.
Even if you don't see it, you have helped sow the seeds from which it will come.
Yes, there were many John Hancocks. There was the cavalier, young and dashing. There was the patriot, warm-hearted and cool-headed. And there was the man who, quiet with grief, admitted me to the Hancock house one other morning I can never forget.
Good morning, Dorothy. Oh, shall I get your bags out of the carriage?
Servants have already taken the carriage around to the side.
Come in.
John, I'm sorry about the death of your uncle.
Yes, it was quite a blow. We expected it, of course, but even so...
Yes, of course.
It was very kind of you to come and be a companion to Aunt Lydia for a while. I'm sure you'll be a most agreeable distraction. And she needs someone to take her mind off her loss.
I was very happy to come, John.
I had thought to be calling on you before this, but with all my uncle's affairs to take care of...
I understand.
I have been thinking of you.
I have been thinking of you.
Oh, excuse me. Jim, come in. What brings you here at this time of day?
There's trouble on the dock, John. Your vessel, the Liberty, is in port, you know.
Yes, of course I know. She's just come in with a cargo.
And your captain got in a row with one of the English customs officials and locked him up on your ship. Crew is putting the goods on dock right now.
Are they?
Well, don't you think you'd better go down and make an attempt to restore order?
No.
You don't?
Jim, the British have been seizing our sailors and forcing them to work on their ships. One of them was rescued only today. I can see no reason under the circumstances to honor the revenue laws or the representatives of the English crown.
You can't openly defy the English crown.
I do openly defy it. And in time, we shall all openly defy it. My ship is well named. I consider her name a good omen.
The Liberty?
The Liberty.
John,
Oh, thank goodness you're home. I heard the shouting in the streets. What has happened?
Ha ha, there's been a riot. They've damaged the homes of the revenue officers, and they may have destroyed the revenue collector's boat. For all I know, by now, they...
You look glad.
I am glad.
This may lead to a war with England.
Yes, it may.
Do you want war?
I want freedom for all of us. I don't want taxation without representation. I want this country to have its own government, its own leaders.
You're talking revolution. You're talking treason.
I'm talking revolution, but not treason. Dorothy, I'm talking loyalty. Loyalty to the original beliefs that brought our fathers to this country. We're not an English colony. We're a new nation. And we must show the world that we're a new nation dedicated to liberty. It's inevitable that we must fight, Dorothy. And the sooner begun, the sooner ended. And the sooner we can set to work establishing the kind of government we want to live under.
You sound as though you actually believe we could win a war with England.
We must win it.
Yes, he often said that. It was part of his dreams. And there was poetry in his dreams. So that even his anger had a sort of poetry in it. As if he knew that history was going to be on his side. There was one night I sat in the study with Aunt Lydia. John was talking to Sam Adams in the next room. We didn't have to eavesdrop. You could have heard him all over the house.
The devil take that blasted tea. I say let's dump it into the harbor.
The king has threatened to transport all rebels to England for trial. Let's not lose sight of that, John.
But, Sam, before he can transport us to England, he's got to capture us and get us out of the country, and that will take some doing.
I could do with a good cup of tea right now.
I'll brew you a cup in Boston Harbor.
If there's any brewing to be done, I'll either hand it in myself. John, if we were to consider such a thing, which, of course, we would not for a moment, how would we get on board?
I've thought of that. We'll put on war paint. There will be an unexpected Indian uprising. It can be done, Sam. We can get on board, dump that tea over, and get off. And no one will ever know who made the attack.
The British won't think it's Indians for 1 minute.
I know they won't, but they won't know who the exact people were. No one will ever know. Are you with me, Sam?
Here's my hand on it, John.
Oh, John, you're back safely. What happened?
Well, if you'd like a cup of tea, you can have a fine, strong one for yourself from Boston Harbor.
John, where is this all going to end?
To live and not to be free, Dorothy, is not to live at all. I don't want to die. None of us do. I want to live in this land, be a part of its growth. I want to raise children that will live as free citizens under an elected government. I want to plan a future with you, Dorothy.
You want to plan a future with me, John?
You knew that, didn't you?
You've never spoken. I wasn't sure how you felt.
These are difficult, uncertain times. I didn't feel I had the right to speak.
In difficult, uncertain times, John, it is well to have some certainty.
Dorothy, then may I go to your father? May I ask him for the honor of your hand in marriage?
Nothing would give me greater happiness.
I may be leading you into a life of great anxiety. Even danger.
Wherever you lead, John, I shall feel privileged to follow.
Well, this has been quite a night for me. I have struck a blow for liberty and surrendered liberty, too. Dorothy, I shall remember the hope of this night as long as I live. The hope of living with you in a free country. We must achieve that hope. For those who live now, and for all who will come after us.
A young man growing up into a troubled age. A young man seeking to change the world. A young man whose dreams became actions. This, we can see, was John Hancock. But the old lady can tell us more, because she too had lived through the troubled years, had seen the outbreak of war between England and America, had watched history come alive in her own town.
Yes. John and Sam Adams were talking there late one night, and there was plenty to talk about. The whole countryside was tense with excitement. Lydia and I joined in the talk occasionally, but mainly we listened. It was great talk between those two. The talk of men who knew they were on the verge of tremendous adventures. And then suddenly a horse clattered up to the front door and a rider dismounted.
Yes?
Mr. Hancock?
Yes.
My name is Revere. I was appointed to watch for the signal in the belfry of North Church.
Has the signal been set?
Yes, two lanterns. That means the enemy under General Gage is marching to attack Concord.
Captain!
Yes, sir?
Send one of your men to the meeting house. Tell them to start the meeting house bell ringing and keep it ringing for the rest of the night.
Yes, sir.
We'll have 150 men together before daybreak.
I must go on with the message. Good night, sir.
Good night, Mr. Revere.
You see what I mean when I say there were many John Hancocks? There was the man of action, the leader, the patriarch cheered by thousands as he rode through the streets. And then the serious, dignified statesman who came back to our house after he had been chosen president of the Continental Congress. Congratulations, John. We're so proud of you.
Well done, John. Your uncle would be proud, too.
Now, wait a minute. I've only been elected president of the Congress. I haven't done anything yet.
You will. What is the first job you must do?
Appoint a committee to draft a Declaration of Independence.
Do you know whom you're going to appoint?
No. I have to think about that a long time. This is one of our first important national documents. The men who draw it up must be of first importance to the nation. And the nation must be of first importance to them. Gentlemen of the Continental Congress, the following are my appointments to the committee to draw up the Declaration of Independence. Robert Livingston, Roger Sherman, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson.
It is my pleasure to inform the President and the members of the Continental Congress that the Declaration of Independence is ready for their signatures. Mr. President, will you be the first to sign?
I consider it a great privilege to be the first to sign this document. John Hancock.
Yes, I knew John Hancock so very well. Memories of him come back to me now. Not in the order of history. Let history take care of that. But in the way life arranges them in my heart. Because I was part of that life. Of his life. Of our life that began on that happy day. Our wedding day. He beside me in the carriage after the ceremony. A young man then. So handsome. I said that before, didn't I? So handsome.
Are you happy?
Very happy. Are you?
If there's a happier man in the colonies today, I'll eat him.
Oh, that's a sweeping statement.
You know, I must have ridden this road 100 times and more during my life. And yet, today it seems as though I'm riding it for the first time.
We're both riding it for the first time. Because we're riding it together. Someday we'll ride here with our children and we'll say to them, on this road, your father and I drove on our wedding day. And our thoughts and plans and dreams were of a future so beautiful it was almost unbearable.
I won't remember thoughts and plans and dreams. I won't remember the road or the morning.
No.
I'll remember only you.
They are all here with me now. John Hancock, first governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. First governor, and then 10 times reelected. And then my last, and perhaps my dearest memory of them all, John Hancock, when he was 57. And life had not been kind to him in every way. Not as kind as history had been.
It seems to be getting dark earlier these days, doesn't it, my dear?
Well, it is October, you know, John. How do you feel this afternoon?
Oh, tired. Very tired. Should one be this tired at only 57? It hardly seems timed.
It's because you've been ill. When you're better, you won't tire so easily.
I wish our children had lived to sit beside me today. The girl there, the boy there. Life is very cruel at times, isn't it, my dear? To have them both with you, love them, and to lose them seems unendurable at times. I shall die without descendants. There'll be no child to live and carry my love for you on into the next generation. What John Hancock felt and was and thought ends here with my passing.
You're in a strange mood, aren't you, my dear? You keep speaking as though this were the end.
If it is the end. I'd like you to remember this. There have been only 2 real loves in my life, Dorothy. You and my country. I may not have lived to see my children gather strength and grow, but I have lived to see my country take its first, unsure steps. I've lived to see those steps become stronger and firmer as a nation of men fought for freedom, achieved freedom, and learned what to do with it when it was theirs. I know not what men will remember of me, anything at all, but I shall remember 2 things with great pride as long as I live. That you put your trust in me, and that my countrymen put their trust in me. And one simple moment, long since over, will remain in my memory. The great moment of my lifetime.
It is my pleasure to inform the President and the members of the Continental Congress that the Declaration of Independence is ready for their signatures. Mr. President, will you be the first to sign?
I consider it a great privilege to be the first to sign this document. John Hancock.
Dana Andrews and James Hilton will return in a moment.
Thank you, Dana, for a really grand performance.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, Mr. Hilton, for I felt it was quite an honor to be asked to play the role of such a great American. And thank you for inviting me to appear on Hallmark Playhouse.
You're always a welcome guest. You know that, Dana. Until next Thursday, then, this is James Hilton saying good night.
The Hallmark Playhouse on Tuned to Yesterday from December 13th, 1951 on CBS. You're listening to An Hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday with your host, Mark Levonier. Now on to The March of Time with Westbrook Van Voorhees as host from March 29th, 1935 on CBS.
The March of Time. Again, Remington Rand presents The March of Time, the reenactment of the news of the week selected and dramatized by the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine. All sorts of business statistics are published, car loadings, bank clearings, kilowatt hours. But they leave untold the most important factor of all, the state of mind of the American businessman, his courage or lack of courage, the degree to which he believes in the future, is willing to plan ahead. Tonight, as the Remington Rand fiscal year comes to its close on March 31st, we are able to make a significant announcement. During the past 12 months, American businessmen have increased their purchases from Remington Rand over 25%. New products and the intelligent activity of the Remington Rand men have helped mightily. But underneath is the truly significant factor. The rising courage of the American businessman who has taken it on the chin for six tough years is now on his feet and fighting back. Men don't buy business equipment unless they expect to do business. We thank our customers for the biggest year since 1930. We interpret our increasing sales as an accurate and nationwide index of business courage.
And now Remington Rand takes pleasure in asking the men they consider to be the ablest historians of our day, the editors of Time, to present their dramatization of memorable scenes from the news of the week, from the March of Time. Volin, South Dakota. Into the small living room of the Charlie Johnson farmhouse near Volin comes 12-year-old Leroy Johnson. His 11-year-old brother, Roger, looks up from the desk.
Does Dad want us to help him with the milk, Roy? He says you're to finish your homework first. What are you writing?
History.
Oh.
We have to write an essay on the American Army. I'm going to write mostly about the horses and the artillery, the big ones that pull the cannons around. Just look at this picture.
Say, they're swell. Wish we had a team like that. Dad could plow up the whole farm then in no time.
Yep. Sure gonna be tough this spring. Trying to do all the plowing again with just old Bessie and Lass.
Say, what do they do with their horses in the army when they get too old?
I don't know. Just nothing, I guess.
Here, Rog, give me a sheet off of that tablet.
Hey, what are you writing?
Just a minute.
What's this? United States War Department? Artillery? Oh, that's crazy, Roy.
She's not. Wait a minute now. Ah, there now. Listen. Dear sirs, I am writing to you to see if you might have an old team of artillery horses that are too old to be of any use that you could give away. My dad has a farm here with a big mortgage on. With 300 acres and only 1 field.
One morning this week, Leroy and Roger sit on the front porch steps of the Johnson farmhouse.
Oh, gosh, Roy. Don't look so sunk.
Oh, I wish we could have gotten those horses.
Oh, the general did everything he could. Listen to what he says. I believe if artillery horses could read letters and could talk, all those that have grown too old for further duty in their country's service would be asking me for the privilege of working for you and Roger.
Yeah, but then he goes on to say that it's against the law to do anything but sell them.
He did his best, Roy.
One of you boys, Leroy Johnson?
Yes, I am, mister.
This place, Bill, ran up close.
Say, are you an army man, mister?
That's right, son. Got some freight for you in this truck.
Horses? For us? But, sir, we didn't really order them. The general said we'd have to buy them. We can't pay.
Let down the backboard and lead them out, Bill.
Gee, look at them, Roy.
Boys, General Burney couldn't help you officially. So these horses are a present from the United States Field Artillery Association, officers and men.
A present?
Every officer and man chipped in 3 cents. When these horses were sold, according to law, we bought them right back. Here you are, kid. That one's Reno and this Buffalo.
Gee, gosh, ain't they beauts? Oh, Dad, Dad, come and see your present from the United States Army. Dad!
Time marches on. Florida.
By force and treachery, the United States government is robbing our cattle, our slaves, and our lands, and wants to send us to Arkansas. We, the Seminole Indians, shall stay here in Florida. There will never be anything but war between us until the Seminoles have driven the Americans from our land.
Thus, exactly 100 years ago, in 1835, Chief Osceola, spokesman for the rich and powerful tribe of Florida Seminole Indians, defies President Andrew Jackson's commands and begins the Seminole War. The government spends $40 million in a campaign lasting 50 years. But the proud Seminole warriors fight stubbornly, savagely on, kill 1,500 U.S. soldiers before they vanish into the trackless Everglades. Broken, poverty-stricken, but still defiant, the Seminoles, unlike all other U.S. Indians, never officially surrender or make overtures of peace. This week, to West Palm Beach come survivors of the ancient tribe, the last of the Seminole braves in picturesque ceremonial dress, to squat on their haunches and, after 100 years, present their peace demands through their spokesman, Chief Sam Tommy, to Harold L. Ickes, U.S. Secretary of the Interior.
What do you Seminoles ask, Chief Tommy?
Only 500 members of Seminole tribe remain alive, Mr. Ickes. My people are starving. We have no homes. The United States government must give us land to live on.
It seems to the government only fair that you should have more land and an opportunity to revive your agriculture and the other ancient arts of your race.
200,000 acres, we ask, here in Florida.
If the government gives you this land, will you obey the laws of the United States?
All but the game laws. We must kill game for food all year round.
I see. Are you willing to swear allegiance to the government of the United States?
Yes. If you give us all rights as citizens and pay $15 a month to each member of the Seminole tribe.
Oh, but why should the government give you pensions, Chief Tommy?
100 years ago, you took the whole state of Florida from us. It is only just that you make payment now.
I don't know whether it'll be possible to give you everything you ask, but I'll take your demands to President Roosevelt. The United States government is proud of the Seminole Indians, Chief Tommy. You're not only a brave people, but you are what white men call good losers.
We have not lost. Unless your president in Washington gives us what we ask, the Seminoles can never make peace with the United States government.
Time marches on.
London, England. This week to London's High Court comes a case that has been watched with burning interest by half the housewives of Great Britain. Before black-robed, white-wigged Justice Talbot sit the principals in the action. Mr. and Mrs. Alexander Frederick Churchill Sim and Mr. and Mrs. Herbert Mercer Stretch of the tiny village of Cookham Dean. Nearby, listening primly, sits 25-year-old Miss Edith Saville. The gowned, bewigged counsel for the Stretches addresses the court.
Your Lordship and gentlemen of the jury, I quote you Exodus, chapter 20. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant. His maidservant, your Lordship. It was in spring of last year that my clients, Mr. and Mrs. Herbert Stretch, moved to the village of Cookham Dean, and there took a house called the Twig. Along with the Twig, they were supposed to receive from its former mistress a very treasure of a girl, Edith, the cook general, who had the highest character for hard work and cleanliness, and was a jewel at bottling fruit. On arrival at the Twig, Mr. and Mrs. Stretch found Edith working temporarily for a family down the road, Mr. and Mrs. Sim. The Sims were reluctant to let Edith go, but after a tart exchange of letters between the ladies, she arrived. Your Lordship, that jealousy then entered the heart of Mr. and Mrs. Sim. It was not many days until, up the side drive of the Stretch home, the Sim motor car crept cautiously. Mr. Sim called to Edith, who was on the back steps of the Twig, and there made a proposition.
Now, Edith.
Oh, Mr. Sim. Good morning.
Edith, come here a moment.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mrs. Sim.
Good morning, Edith. Are the Stretches at home?
No, ma'am. They've gone down to the village.
Good. We thought they had.
Edith, we were so terribly sorry to hear of the death of your pet cat.
Oh, Mum, don't speak of poor Harry. I'm fair sick to think of him.
There's a story going about that it wasn't a natural death.
Why, sir, there's no doubt someone gave Harry poison.
Then it was someone Harry knew and trusted, I'll wager.
And I understand Mrs. Stretch abominates cats.
Oh, Mum, you wouldn't think...
What I think is that you ought to see a solicitor about the cat. Don't you agree, Joyce?
I most certainly do. Hop in, Edith. We'll drive you to our solicitor in Maidenhead right now.
Oh, Mum and me in the midst of cleaning the pantry?
Hurry, Edith.
Oh, I ought not to be doing this.
Now get right in. That's a girl.
My God, Frederick. Edith, consider yourself kidnapped.
Why, fancy that now. Do I understand? That is, you're keeping me, Mr. Sims? But I'm in me house dress, sir. I've got no money or clothes or wages. Oh, and I just thought, I bought some greens at the market yesterday and paid for them myself.
Splendid. We'll wire Stretch. Let me see. We'll say, Edith is resuming her service with us today. Please send the money you borrowed from her.
Splendid, Frederick. Tell them off. We've got Edith.
Thus the High English Court and all England, in columns and columns of press reports, learn how the accused, Mr. and Mrs. Sim, breaking the Bible's 10th commandment, enticed maidservant Edith. This week, the court finds them guilty of criminal enticement and libel. Finds them £625, nearly $300. But final conclusive lesson to British housewives covetous of maidservants is the comment of treasured, kidnapped Edith Saville herself.
I shall never work for either one of those families again. Now the trial's over, I'll be taking a fortnight's holiday and then looking for a new situation.
Time marches on. Washington, D.C. The congressional enactment this week brings sharply back into the news the once-famed polar expedition of Lieutenant Adolphus Washington Greely. Sent out in 1881 by the United States government to establish an observation station at Franklin Bay on Grinnell Land within 500 miles of the North Pole.
The short summer of 1883 is drawing to a close. Wearied by 2 years of strenuous exploration, Lieutenant Greely leads his party of 24 soldiers southward over jagged ice packs to Cape Sabine, where rendezvous with a relief party on the steamer Proteus is expected. With Lieutenant Lockwood at his side, Greely climbs to an old campsite on a bluff facing south.
Lieutenant Greely, they failed us.
Certainly no boat in sight.
And all open water there to the south. They would have had no trouble getting through.
It's possible they've been here and gone. Men, spread out over the campsite. Search for any cache of supplies or any message. It's only the 9th of October, Lieutenant. There'll still be a week or two of boats to get through before the ice closes up.
And if they don't come, we've got food for 40 days and 9 months of winter ahead.
Lieutenant Greely.
What is it, Sergeant?
There's a bottle with a message in it, sir.
Found in that pile of rocks. Well, they've been here then. Let's see. Yes, it's from the Proteus.
What's the news, sir?
Here it is. Steamer Proteus was crushed in the ice and sank off this point on July 23rd. All hands rescued. I will leave for the south as soon as possible and endeavor to communicate with another boat now coming north. Everything within the power of man will be done to rescue the Greely party. Signed, E.A. Garlinson, First Lieutenant Commander. Well, that means we'll have to camp here and wait.
That was dated 10 weeks ago, Lieutenant Greely. I believe we'd better try to go on south and disregard the message.
We can't do that. My orders from the government were to come here. Lieutenant Garlington knows our situation. He or the other boat will come through to us here. We've got to stand by our orders and wait.
Greely and his 24 men begin their wait. They cannot know that Lieutenant Garlington's party has hurried south without attempting to send another relief party. and the government has already decided to leave the expedition helplessly marooned until spring. 2 weeks pass. The ice closes up. The 40 days' rations are divided up in starvation portions to last until February. The sunless winter sets in. In January, the first man dies. In March, the survivors of the forgotten Greeley expedition begin to eat moss, then their leather clothes. April goes by. Then May. At last, on June 22nd, 1884, breaking all records for early Arctic navigation, Captain W.F. Sly breaks through with a Navy steamer to Cape Sabine, sets out with a small searching party.
I've been here, sir. See there, some sort of a shelter.
It's a tent, all blown over.
Yes, looks like they tried to winter here, poor devils.
Here's a body, sir.
Guess they couldn't bury him at the last.
Just a search for the bodies now, I'm afraid. There should be 25 of them.
Captain Schley.
Yes?
Look right there by the tent. Something moving.
It's a man. Hello. Hello. Wait. Don't try to get up. Get your brandy out, Lieutenant Emery.
Yes, sir.
You've come. Easy now. Here, let me help you.
Here's the brandy, sir.
Right. Now drink this. There. Can you tell us? Is this Lieutenant Greeley's party?
I am Greeley.
I'm Commander Schley, in charge of the United States Rescue Party. Is this all of your party?
Lieutenant Greeley reporting, Commander. Party of seven survivors, polar expedition. Established world's record. Farthest north for United States. Explorations entirely successful.
Hurried south to a hospital, Lieutenant Greeley wins the world's praise for his heroic part in the worst Arctic tragedy in U.S. history. But no recognition, no official reward comes from the government. In 1908, after a distinguished life of Army service, quietly he retires, his name almost forgotten. This week, 27 years later, Washington reporters descend on the modest cottage in Georgetown, D.C., where lives 91-year-old General Greeley, are ushered into his living room.
Just sit down here by the fire, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We're newspaper men, just come over from Washington, General Greeley. Today, Congress has voted you the Congressional Medal of Honor for your Arctic expedition.
Well, appreciate that. You know, I used to have a lot of medals from England, France, Russia, Sweden, and some of those other countries because of that expedition. I don't know what's become of them. Yes, they were all lost in the San Francisco fire. You know, when you get to be 90, medals don't seem as important as they do when you're younger.
Time marches on. Germany. One morning this week, the world tensely focuses on an office in the German Realm Chancellery. Behind a huge document-piled desk, Adolf Hitler holds forth to England's Minister of Peace, quiet Sir John Simon. In secret conversation, the Reichsführer pours out an uninterrupted guttural monologue of German oratory and German demands. No one knows exactly what Sir John Simon heard, but from the week semi-official reports of the Hitler talk, political observers by the weekend are forming new comprehension of the essential European question of today. What does Nazi Germany want?
The Versailles Treaty seized our land to create the Polish corridor and made of it foreign soil separating the fatherland from East Prussia. We demand that the powers keep hands off while Poland and Germany settle this question between themselves.
To all good Germans, the only conceivable settlement is return of the Polish corridor. As recompense, Berlin suggests that Poland annex her neighbor, tiny Lithuania. But Lithuania is present ally and past province of Russia. Can Hitler gain the corridor without a Russian war?
Germany will never return to the League of Nations unless she is admitted on grounds of complete equality. We demand that at least one of the fatherland's colonies of which we were robbed after the war shall be returned to us.
All Germany's pre-war colonies have been handed over to supervision and rule by the Allies. Shantung to China, the South Pacific Islands to Japan, Samoa, New Guinea, and the great African colonies of Togoland, East Africa, Southwest Africa to Great Britain. Observers see no possible chance for Hitler to get back these colonies by peaceful means.
Despite the objections of certain powers, we demand that the citizens of Austria be allowed to vote on whether they want to form an economic union with Germany.
Between Germany and Austria stands Il Duce, who mobilized 140,000 troops on the border when Nazis murdered Chancellor Adolphus last summer. Observers believe Mussolini will go to war overnight if Hitler attempts again to seize power in Austria.
When the world is ready to disarm, so is Germany. Meanwhile, we demand, as our right, man for man equality with Russia, gun for gun equality with France, and plane for plane equality with England.
In 1914, the German army was the most powerful in the world. Today, if Hitler gets his new war machine ready to back his other demands, Hitler will have not only an air force equal to the greatest in Europe, but an army greater than the Kaiser's. As Sir John Simon and the British cabinet ponder Hitler's elaborate demands, as France hastens to cement a powerful alliance with Russia, the attention of the world turns to Italy, where next month in the quiet, beautiful town of Stresa on Lake Maggiore, England, France, and Italy will meet for a three-power parley that may be a last roundup on Adolf Hitler. Time marches on. Garden City, New York. In the living room of their small Garden City apartment, blonde, curly-headed James E. Collins, 31, one of the few U.S. air test pilots, sits with a pile of written sheets at his elbow, scribbling rapidly as his wife comes quietly in.
Hello, Dolores.
Hello, dear.
I've become a writer.
A writer?
Mm-hmm.
You? Oh, Jimmy, whoever heard of an aviator becoming a writer?
Well, writers can't be any poorer than test pilots anyhow. Do you know how many months it is since anybody hired me to test a plane?
I don't care, Jimmy. I don't want you to test any more planes.
No fun testing planes. No fun being without a job and having to live off your father, either. Anyway, I got this idea.
Yes, Jimmy?
Well, it's an article.
Yes?
I think I'll call it Return to Earth, about some of my experiences in the air. Now, I thought maybe if a magazine would publish it, I might get a few test jobs to do.
Oh, no. Not test jobs, please. Why should you risk your life trying out those new planes?
Somebody's got to. It's the only way I know how to make a living. Gee, Dolores, you don't think I like diving. Here, listen to this I've just written. I leveled off, jammed the stick forward. My last dive. I thought of my wife and kids. It was a swell day. I started down. 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 Centrifugal force, like some huge invisible monster, pushed my head down on my shoulders and squashed me into that seat. I groaned with the force of it. It drained the blood from my head and started to blind me. I watched the accelerometer through a deepening haze. 375, 380, 385 miles an hour. I was blind as a bat. I was dizzy as a coot. I couldn't see my wings. I couldn't see anything. I could feel my guts being sucked down as I fought for sight and consciousness.
Oh, Jimmy, promise me you'll never do another test job, no matter how much we need the money.
Gee, Dolores, you talk as if I had so many orders I could throw them down.
Jimmy, promise.
Well, we'll see how I turn out as a writer.
As he is finishing his article, Jimmy Collins gets a contract to make 10 dives testing a new Navy plane. Then the Saturday Evening Post accepts his story, Return to Earth, pays him $500. Famed publisher Joseph M. Patterson, reading his Post article, offers him a regular job writing a syndicated aviation column in the New York Daily News at $100 a week. Early one day this week, Jimmy Collins goes to the Farmingdale flying field to fulfill his test contract. Gloved, helmeted, goggled, he stands by the tiny Navy plane talking to his wife.
Well, old girl, this is the last dive I'll ever have to make.
Oh, Jimmy, I can hardly believe it. You, a newspaper man.
Yeah, $100 a week for writing about this business. Much better than doing it, I'd say.
Oh, Jimmy, must you go up again today?
Sure, why not? It's the last time. You know, I contracted to test this little crate before I landed that writing job. Now, don't you worry.
I won't, Jimmy.
I'm as tickled as you are. Well, time I got going, darling.
Be back in a few minutes. So long.
Pilot Jimmy Collins takes the untried Navy flyer up and up, levels it off at 3 miles altitude. Spectators on the field know from his own description in his article, Return to Earth, how he feels.
10,000 feet. My last dive. It's a swell day. I'm a bit afraid. Oh, shucks. Why should I be? I've dived airplanes before. 6 years ago, I dived one to pieces. That's what's the matter with me. I keep remembering that. I keep remembering the exploding crack of those wings tearing off. The awful yanking jerk of that control stick. I keep remembering the dazing blow of the instrument board in my head. The dead, still drop. Whining, screaming second of tensing fear. The earth rushing up at me. My guts sucking down.
The control stick suddenly jerks out of Jimmy Collins' hand. It is Jimmy Collins' last return to Earth.
Time marches on.
Next Friday at the same hour, the editors of Time will again present The March of Time. Time marches on. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The March of Time, on Tuned 2 yesterday from March 29th, 1935 on CBS, one of the first few surviving broadcasts from that series, the earliest being in March of 1931, the first show of the series. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned 2 yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.